And, of course, Dr. Ben Edwards here on the show, Melody Wilkes, health coach as well. I'm Hello. Wade Wilkes. Hello, everybody. Glad Good to see morning, you back Wade. Here on this Monday. What's going on in your neck of the woods?
Well, just kind of same old, same old.
Same old,
Stomping
same
out
old.
Disease and pestilence.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
We'll helping, take it from there.
Helping patients,
you
too.
You didn't wear your Superman suit.
Yeah, what's up with that?
Teaching patients. That's what we do. We just teach.
Okay.
So it's good. Everything's
you know,
good at Veritas.
I love the little micro tune-up thing I get all the time. Those
good.
Are fun.
Good feedback. Yeah, our education department has started doing these little one-minute clips that our members get via text, little education tune-ups. We call them micro tune-ups, just to remind people of all the things that we've been teaching them over the years. Because human nature is to drift back in our old habits and our old mindsets. And
yeah.
So it's good to stay up to date.
I want to get into a subject that I've been dying to ask you about. And this is something that, you know, again, you've mentioned it, you've talked about it before, but we get a lot of texts and a lot of calls on this. But as it pertains to weight loss, as it pertains to, you know, again, eating right, getting normal exercise, okay. Well, the intermittent fast diet, we're getting a lot of questions about this. And, yeah. And what is, generally speaking, the best way to go? I had thought about trying it starting today. I was already kind of doing intermittent fast already when I don't have breakfast, maybe a small lunch, and then the majority of my calories in the evening. But I thought, well, I'm going to try, you know, not eating today all day tomorrow and then having my first meal tomorrow evening. Because I don't have the ups and downs of crazy blood sugars as, say, Melody would, for example, or some other people who say, man, I couldn't go 4 hours without eating, without getting all spaced out and wigged out and all that kind of stuff. But could you explain to us a little bit more, Dr. Edwards, about the intermittent fasting? I hate to use the term diet, but just it's a lifestyle change, actually.
Yeah, it's really just a pattern of eating. And I encourage people to vary, to change up their eating patterns. Don't just get stuck, even with this intermittent fasting. You know, your body likes to see variation. And that's really kind of the root of this whole thought process of intermittent fasting is going back, you know, hundreds of years ago, when people didn't have food readily available 24/7 at the corner store, there are periods where they did not have calories going into their mouth. Now, that could be periods of hours or days, sometimes weeks. But then you'd come upon that food, whether it was a harvest or you found some game that you were able to kill and process. And so then you have calorie intake, and it's a lot. It's kind of like a feast and famine. So we're trying to kind of mimic some of that our native ancestors and the way they would eat. So it's really about not eating for a period of time. And again, there's different ways to do it. So the minimum is 18 hours. So basically that's skip breakfast, skip lunch, eat a big supper, and then, you know, don't eat again breakfast and lunch the next day. So that's about 18 hours that you're skipping. So it's what you're doing is just causing the body to have to use its energy stores to burn up glycogen, burn up blood sugar, and then get into your fat stores and start burning fat for fuel, which is a very, very healthy thing to do. When you burn fat for fuel, it's a very clean burning fuel. The byproducts of that fat burn in your cells don't damage your cells near as much as burning sugar does.
So that's kind of a myth that it lowers your metabolism to...
No, what lowers your metabolism is restricted calories on a consistent basis. So if you're trying to restrict down to 500 calories and you're eating little tiny meals, breakfast, lunch, and supper to only add up to 500 or 800 or 1,000 calories, that's called calorie restriction, but you're still getting calories in all throughout the day. They're just restricted. That will shut your metabolism down.
Well, let me ask you this. So are you suggesting then to do the intermittent fast 7 days a week and just only eat in that one time block?
That's one way to do it. but I wouldn't do that forever.
Okay.
So vary it up. Dr. Dan Pompa, who's one of the gurus in intermittent fasting, actually gives his patients a rule of 5-1-1. So 5 days you do your 18-hour intermittent fast.
Okay.
1 day you do a 24-hour fast, and then 1 day you do a feast where you eat all three meals. Then he has a 3-2-2. So 3 days of the 18 hours, 2 days of 24 hours, and then, or so that'd be 48 hours, and then 2 days of fasting. There's another variation where it's 6 days of nothing but bulletproof coffee, and then on your seventh day you feast, breakfast, lunch, and supper of a feast, and you have good carbs in there too, so it's not a low carb thing on your feast day. So there's all different ways to do it. You can go 24 on, 24 off, back and forth, just keep doing that. You can just do the 18 hour deal every day, and but every now and then you got to mix it up. Your body will get in this rut, but what you're really doing is becoming hormone sensitive. When you're not eating for 18 hours or 24 or 48 or 72, or I mean the longest known recorded fast was like 380 days.
Oh my gosh.
That was in a 400-pound gentleman, and so he had a lot of reserves in his pantry.
Wow.
He burned a lot of fat. But when you're fasting, you can drink water, you can drink coffee, you can drink tea, bone broth, but then when you eat, you need to really eat. But the key is don't eat food that's going to spike your insulin. So when you eat in the evening, you really don't want to do a ton of processed grain and sugar because you're going to spike insulin. Insulin this tells you to store fat. Insulin is pro-inflammatory.
So your first meal needs to be high protein.
I'd say high fat, moderate protein.
High fat.
Or even 50-50 on the protein fat.
Okay. Protein
and
fat ratio.
And healthy carbs, low glycemic carbs, purple potatoes, sweet potatoes, quinoa, black rice, stuff like that.
Okay. So in my case, and I'm looking at I want to lose 30
pounds.
He
wants to do 2 days in a row.
I was thinking 2 days in a row.
That's fine.
And then then go back to normal eating. What, a couple of days or whatever?
Yeah.
And then,
but
I don't know.
Depending on how insulin resistant you are, it may take a while to see the results.
Sure.
I mean, some people, even going pretty consistent intermittent fasting, it'll take them 2 or 3 months to really kick in that insulin sensitivity, because what you're really doing is cleaning up inflammation of your cell membrane, your mitochondrial membrane. You're getting those receptors, those hormone receptors, cleaned up. You're teaching your body how to respond to growth hormone and leptin and ghrelin and all these hormones that control fat storage and fat metabolism. Growth hormone goes up 1300% after 1 day of intermittent fasting, which is a good thing. You want more growth hormone. It's the repair hormone. So that's really what you're doing, is starting to manipulate your hormones, getting the beneficial hormones to come up, getting your fat storage and the inflammatory hormones to come down. So I would say just stick with it. And it's not so much about eating less. It's about eating less often.
Yeah.
That's the key.
So maybe in my situation, maybe try out an every other 24-hour, every other 24-hour fast.
And then
normal,
eat. Yep.
And 24-hour fast,
yep.
And normal, so on and so forth.
Yeah, that'd be great.
That would work as well.
Uh-huh. And for people that really are way overweight, you know, Dave Asprey, the Bulletproof Man, he has this kind of rapid weight loss, 75 pounds in 75 days is kind of his trademark deal. But it's the Bulletproof Coffee twice a day for 6 days, and that seventh day you feast, and you do
this
for 30 days.
Bulletproof Coffee has...
Bulletproof Coffee is grass-fed butter and coconut oil, or MCT oil.
And
which
both. Not either or, but both.
Both together in a good, high-quality coffee. Now, careful with your coffee. 90% of coffee is pesticide-ridden, and coffee tends to take up the chemicals way more than any other plant. So coffee is one of the most toxic things you could drink. So you want to get shade-grown, organic coffee. It'll be... a lot cleaner, and lots of nutrients in coffee, and coffee's good if you get the right kind. But when you add the grass-fed butter and the coconut oil to it, that's good fat, and it will help flip your body's metabolism into that fat burn mode that I'm talking about. When sugar's not available, glucose from carbs is not available, you will burn fat. And when you put fat into the body, like in the Bulletproof Coffee, then it triggers it even faster.
Could you do decaf coffee, or do you need to have
that? You could. Right. Yeah, you can do decaf. And you mix all this up in a blender. So the butter and the coconut oil become this creamy, it's basically like adding cream to the coffee. So it's really good. And you can add pure chocolate, like cocoa powder, cinnamon, nutmeg, whatever flavors you like, but not sugar. You know, I did Bulletproof this morning, had some pure cocoa powder and the grass-fed butter and the coconut oil.
Okay. Interesting. That's what we'll do. All right, let's go out to phones. I think we have our guest on for today's program, and Nelson Coulter. You might want to
bring
him back in there, Dr. Edwards.
Yeah, we'll do. For those of you who were not with us a couple of weeks ago, we had Nelson Coulter on the show. It was a great show. Nelson Coulter is a former superintendent of the Guthrie Common School District down in the Four Sixes country. And just a brief synopsis of that show. Nelson and I met 3 or 4 years ago. I was able to give a talk to his staff out at the school there at Guthrie, and basically over some time, a lot of his staff and then eventually even the students were able to implement some diet and lifestyle changes that really improved the health of not only Nelson and his wife, but the staff and even some of the students. You know, some of the most memorable parts of that show from 2 weeks ago to me were when Nelson said, you know, he had that thought, that moment in his life where he had this thought that my life will never be the same. This is information I've learned, and I've seen in my own body the health benefits of changing the way I eat, and there's no way that I could continue to serve food to these kids that I know is going to set them on a course for the rest of their life towards disease. He just, in his conscience, in his morals and ethics, he couldn't do that. He knew he had to find a way to feed good food. He said, you know, if I'm not going to eat it, if I won't even feed it to myself, how can I feed it to these kids? So, you know, that was a great show. Nelson, thank you for sharing that story with us. But this week's show that I wanted to get into is what Nelson Coulter's doing these days, because he retired from his official duties as superintendent. He does do some consulting with schools still in school districts, but he's really living his passion now, which is permaculture. So that's going to be the topic of today's show. And we do talk about agriculture a lot on here because there's such a link between the food that goes in our mouth and our health. You know, that inflammation we always talk about, most inflammation is driven from the gut and driven from the poor diet that we had. You know, we talked with the raw dairyman a few weeks back, and he talked about how that fat, homogenized fat, is pro-inflammatory. It's oxidized LDL cholesterol, which is the bad cholesterol. But it gets that way because we homogenize it. You know, raw milk that's not homogenized is actually very beneficial fat. So the things we do to change our food and process our food, usually because it's chasing a dollar, we can get more shelf life on a food product and therefore make more of a profit margin on our bottom line. Those things that we do to change our food are pro-inflammatory almost always. So getting food back to the basics of how God intended it to be, original, unadulterated God food is what I call it, is the absolute essential component of health. You know, we have so many diseases that we see in patients at our clinic go into remission or be reversed, whether that be Crohn's and ulcerative colitis or rheumatoid arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, type 2 diabetes, asthma, eczema, ADD. You just go down the list. All these diseases are diseases of inflammation. And we see reversals of these diseases where people are off their meds and symptom-free, mainly because they address their diet. You've got to put real food in your mouth. So there's such a huge connection between health and what we do in a functional medicine clinic and food that we do like to bring in folks who are in the food production business and the agricultural business to kind of talk about that some. You know, let thy food be thy medicine is what one great doctor said 2,000 years ago, named Hippocrates. So anyways, today we're going to talk about that some with Nelson. So Nelson, welcome to the show. Good to have you back.
Well, I'm glad to be back, Doc. Sorry, I had you on my calendar for next Monday. I'm on the road to Austin, so we'll talk. A couple of comments right off the bat. First, intermittent fasting works. My wife and I have been doing that for several months, and it's amazing. It's just another step in our learning about total and improved health. Your body can relearn how to burn fat, and it's really and it's amazing to me because I work out on the ranch every day now. And there was a time, you know, if I wasn't putting something in my mouth to eat every 2 to 3 hours, I thought I was starving.
Yeah.
And I can drink coffee in the morning and work on my ranch until 1, 2, even 3 o'clock in the afternoon today now, and really don't get hungry.
Yeah, that's awesome.
We eat one real meal per day now, and we try to squeeze all of our eating into certainly an 8-hour window of time, and following mostly the guidance of Dr. Joseph Mercola. He's a real advocate of that.
Yeah, Dr. Mercola, Dr. Pompa, Dave Asprey, all these guys are real proponents, and I'll just echo that. One of my staff members, our patient advocate, former office manager Angie Romans, loves to go on long bicycle rides. You know, these long 60-mile rides, these races, and she eats like this, and she tells me that she'll have more energy when she crosses that finish line when she's in this intermittent fasting, ketogenic kind of state. Her body's in this fat burn metabolism mode, and even in a lean person, when you like someone like myself, you look at me and think, "Well, he doesn't have any fat to burn." You,
That's
true. You do. I mean, all intermingled under my skin.
You're a bean pole.
Intermingled in my muscles. I've got over 45,000 kilocalories to
burn.
He
means that in the best way.
Oh, I do.
Thank you.
Very,
I took
very
it
much
in,
so.
In the best way. And Nelson, I'm sorry. I probably got my calendar wrong. So if you're getting a dead spot on the road, or if we just need to go to next week, we can. But
no problem. I'm good.
Okay.
And my second comment, too, you mentioned having a dairy person on your show recently. My wife, and part of our permaculture journey is we have slowly, little by little, and I think you're aware of this, acquired dairy animals, and we raise our own dairy and have been moving toward only A2 females, which is a higher quality milk than the A1, A2, or A1, A1, and that you can explain that technically if you want to, but bottom line is this: high-quality, fat-laden milk and dairy products, butter, yogurt, kefir, yeah, we consume it.
That's
not quality fat and not homogenized, not pasteurized.
Yeah,
and we've made attempts at my wife's made attempts at becoming a better cheesemaker, and that's a great learning journey in itself.
Well,
not dissimilar from learning how to play a piano. Can't do it in one day.
Right. Well, y'all are to be commended and congratulated on your efforts to learn all this stuff. But tell us, let's go back a little bit. You know, we left off the show last time with the story of the transformation of the Guthrie School Lunch Cafeteria and divorcing yourself from the federal school lunch program. Also found it really interesting, the government employee down in Austin, when you were talking on the telephone with her about divorcing from the program, how they were fine with it when you're talking about organic vegetables and even the meat, but you got to the dairy and the grains, and they had a big problem with that.
I mean, if you read the food pyramid, which many of us, I'm an old guy now, I'm almost 60, and I grew up on the food pyramid. You know, that thing probably should be turned upside down.
Yep.
From the actual recommendation. But, when I informed them that we were not going to be dosing our children with 6 doses of grain every day, they objected to that, and I didn't even get to the point where the grain, as you just mentioned in some comments previously, much of it genetically modified, and almost all of it dosed with poison.
Yeah, glyphosate or Roundup.
Right.
Well, so you learned this stuff for personally, you and your wife, and transformed your health. You brought it to your staff, to the school, transformed the cafeteria at school. Is it somewhere in that process where you started to think about producing food yourself for your family and the permaculture thing? Tell us how you got into that. Has that always been kind of an interest in your mind or in your heart, or did you just start to develop that as you were getting into this change of profession?
The personal wellness stuff that you referenced kind of accelerated our learning. My wife and I bought our first piece of property in Kent County out between Lubbock and Abilene about almost 25 years ago and began running beef cattle for commercial purposes while I was still pursuing my career in education. So it was not a full-time operation, but we, in our mind, it was always going to be our retirement. Little by little, even as we acquired additional pieces of property, not knowing what we were doing, we realized that the high input agriculture cultivation practices were not something that we were interested in, and we kept studying over a 20-year period and coming across literature and practitioners. First it was no-till farming, and then but ways of trying to live an agricultural life in a sustainable way and produce income without the high volume input. So it was early in our early learning, it was mostly about money.
Right.
And then as time went by, we became less and less comfortable about the use of chemicals, both on the ground and on the animals. And so we began investigating, and we came across the teachings of people like Alan Savory. Mm-hmm. You may be familiar with him. I think you mentioned to me that you had actually interviewed Joel Salatin.
Right.
We were reading his stuff probably 10 years ago. And again, this is before we got involved in the journey of a personal health improvement. It was mostly about, how can we generate income off of, through our agricultural practices with reduced input. It was really not so much about health. But then 4 years ago, as we talked about the last time I visited with you and as you referenced, we became very aware of the food that we were consuming and the insidious and negative impact on our personal health. I still kick myself wandering around for four decades believing that food manufacturers and big ag had my health in their interest. But bottom line is this. Those two journeys that we were on, one, trying to become better stewards and more sustainable practitioners in agricultural practice, combined with our learning journey about personal health, those things began to merge, and it's amazing how intertwined and entangled they are, and in fact inseparable.
Mm-hmm.
The arguments you make for one actually are the same arguments you make for the other one.
Right.
My personal health, as you are well aware, cuts all the way to the cellular and even beyond that mitochondrial level. And when you think about growing real food and taking care of the land and the animals and the plants that live on your land, it cuts to the cellular level, exactly the same as in our body.
Right.
And so we began to intensify our learning in the last 3 or 4 years about sustainable, and I've used that word several times, and really not sustainable, if that's not the best word. Conservation is not the best word at this point in our lives, in our history, and on our planet. Probably the better word is regenerative. That we have inherited a land and a planet that has been greatly degraded because of our practices, I believe. And so those of us that have the opportunity to be stewards of a piece of that land and the beating hearts that live on it, I have a responsibility to try to regenerate the life of that land and those animals and those plants in a way that, as you know, through the intelligent design, it was designed for abundance, as were our bodies. They were designed to be healthy and prosper. And so we are carefully and engaging in a process of self-educating and learning to move our property and our practices, our daily practices, the animals we caretake and the plants that we caretake toward sustained health so that they can rebuild and regenerate and prosper. quickly, let me make a comment about permaculture, because you used that word, and basically it was coined by a gentleman that we just lost in the last few months from New Zealand named Bill Mollison. He and a few others, probably 30, maybe even 40 years ago, began to have real questions about the sustainability of agricultural practices. And he was a product of and an academician in the world of agriculture, and became real suspicious that the things that we were engaging in from a purely commercial perspective were not going to be sustainable in the long term, both for the health of the planet as well as for being able to feed the people that live on the planet. And so he began studying, even back then, practices that he felt like would allow people to feed themselves locally, feed themselves healthily, and at the same time be good for the land and good for the planet. And so the term that he ended up coining was one of permaculture. And boy, if you do a word search on Google now, you're gonna get more hits than you can read. It is quite a worldwide movement right now. But it basically hinges on three tenets. First, care of people. It's a fundamental focus on taking care of people. The second tenet is care of the planet. And the third tenet is return of surplus. Or in other words, another way to think of that is waste nothing. Think of everything in terms of the way it is recyclable and reusable and is used to regenerate more life and more abundance. So that's the short version of permaculture. I'll shut up and let you ask a question if it comes to your mind, or if it doesn't, then just give me the green light and I'll keep talking.
Okay. Well, I think this may be a good time to take a little break at the bottom of the hour, and then we'll come back and we'll get into some questions for you.
Very good.
Okay.
Hold on. We'll be right back with more right here on You're the Cure. Welcome back into You're the Cure right here on AM 580 with Dr. Ben Edwards, MD. And, of course, a special guest on the show with us today is Nelson Coulter. Nelson, you still with us?
I am.
Good. Great. Glad to continue on with you this morning on the show.
Well, and I want to go back to what Nelson was just saying, the three tenets of permaculture, that taking care of people. Obviously, that goes right with what we do in the field of medicine. I mean, we all went to medical school to help people and take care of people. And, you know, what I've found out through my years of practice is that just managing symptoms with pharmaceuticals is one way to try to help people. But the long-term consequences of that are we die younger and we suffer more. So it's a short-term fix. Long-term, it's a problem. And it costs a lot of money, too. So really, I came to understand I'm not really helping people. So then you realize the only way to really help people is help assist them in letting their own body heal themselves. And what the body needs is the raw materials to get the job done. The raw materials come from the food. You know, minerals, magnesium, calcium, zinc, iron, copper. Your body can't manufacture these minerals. You've got to eat and absorb these minerals. And minerals are needed for every chemical process in the body. You know, enzymes are the things that actually do the work, but an enzyme is made of a mineral, a vitamin, and an amino acid. Those three put together form enzymes. And enzymes are all throughout the body doing all the work in the body. For example, when the sunshine hits your skin, you change the cholesterol in your skin into vitamin D. The thing that does that work, that makes that change, is an enzyme. It takes that cholesterol and turns it into the hormone vitamin D. And you have enzymes like that all over the place. So you've got to have the raw materials to make the enzymes. And I want to just run through real quick, you know, talking about these raw materials, minerals in particular, you've got to get them from the food, but the food's got to get them from the soil. And our soil's been so depleted because of the practices of agriculture over the past 50 to 60 years or so. So I was doing some studying recently and wanted to run down these statistics with you. And this is about vitamin and mineral content of different foods. There was a study put out by the USDA, looked at foods in the 1950s versus foods in 1990. So carrots, the vitamin A content of carrots was 1,000 IUs, international units, back in 1950. 1990, it was down to 583, about a 50% drop. They looked at beets, and the amount of vitamin C in a beet was at 10 milligrams back in the 50s. Now it's at 4.9 in 1990. Broccoli, calcium, 130 milligrams in the 50s, 48 milligrams on average in the 90s. Cauliflower, vitamin B, 10 milligrams, down to 0.063. So almost complete depletion of vitamin B in the cauliflower in 1990. Collards, vitamin A, 6,870 IUs back in 1950, down to 3,800 IUs now. So again, a 50% drop. The vitamin C in collards has gone down from 100 milligrams to 35 milligrams, 65% drop. And we see this across the board. This is just a sampling. There was another study out of UCLA back in 1997. They concluded that it would take 43 bowls of spinach in 1997 to equal one bowl of spinach from 1953 as far as the iron content. And pretty much every food you look at, this is what we see. Total depletion of the foods as far as vitamins and minerals go. A big part of that is because of the way we farm. When we till the soil, you kill the microbes in the soil, you leave the soil uncovered, the UV light to irradiate the soil, but mainly it's the microbes in the soil that die. When you spray the soil, it kills the microbes. You've got to have the microbes and the organic matter in the soil to keep the microbes healthy, to allow the minerals to be changed from into a water-soluble form. The minerals are in the pebbles and stones and rocks and sand and just in the dirt, but it has to be changed into a water-soluble form for the plant to take up, and it's the microbes that do that. So that's a big part of why we've depleted the nutrients in our food. Another reason is because we harvest these things before they're vine-ripen, because we've got to ship them 1,500 miles across the country or across the world, so they'll still look pretty and be ripe when they're sitting in the grocery store. And when you harvest these things too early, that's before the vitamins and minerals are really fully generated in that plant.
Even organics, aren't they sprayed with a gas so they'll be...
Yeah, there's still ways that the organic food can be manipulated, and even if they're not sprayed with anything, it's just the fact they had to be picked a week early or 10 days early. That's the biggest thing. So vine ripened, locally grown, that's the goal. And the reason I'm always harp on this so much is because it makes our job as physicians so much easier when people have access to this kind of medicine, vitamin A, vitamin C, vitamin B, the calcium, the mag, all the minerals. And I'm calling it medicine. Again, the medicine, let thy food be thy medicine, is what I'm talking about. Us as doctors can't heal anyone. It's the patient's own body that has to do the healing. All the testimonials on our website of these quote-unquote diseases that went away, we didn't do anything special from the doctor standpoint. We didn't have any magical potion or supplement or medicine. All we did was educate, encourage, and try to make a way for these patients to get the nutrients in. And you get the nutrients in, then the body heals itself. So that's kind of a long spill on just to reinforce the fact that patients won't get better unless you can fill their pantries up with these raw materials. And so that speaks to the permaculture, because when you produce food in a way as permaculture teaches, you're going to have more nutrient-dense food. Not only are you stewarding that land properly and regenerating that land, but the end result, from my perspective on the food portion, is a nutrient-dense food product, and that's the way people get better, consume nutrient-dense food. So, Nelson, quick question for you. You mentioned what the third tenet in permaculture was to, I forget the word you used, but basically you want to use every single portion of what you produce. You want to reuse or somehow utilize that, not have any waste. So give us an example. What does that look like in your day-to-day operation? Are you talking just composting or what?
So that tenet is called return of surplus.
Okay.
Before I comment on that, that most of the data you cited, Dr. Edwards, on the diminishment of the nutritional efficacy of the fruits and vegetables you mentioned had the last date you mentioned was 1990. That was only 27 years ago.
Right.
There is no doubt in my mind that that data is far worse now than even what you were citing.
Yeah.
On the issue of return of surplus, I mean, a lot of people do compost, for sure. But essentially, and there's lots of ways, there's a lot of ways to compost. And again, if you do a Google search or if you go on one of the permaculture forums, you can get all kinds of information on 18-day compost technology, methodologies. The return of surplus is this. I mentioned this earlier. I just went in our NOAA pass. I didn't lose you, did I?
No, we're still here.
Okay. The systems, the interconnected systems, are designed to feed each other as well as themselves, just like the human body. You and I cannot exist with only a skeletal system. You and I cannot exist with only a muscular system. We can work like crazy in the weight room and make our biceps strong as hell, but without the endocrine system and the digestive system and the reproductive system, it doesn't matter.
Right.
The same thing's going on with our Earth and the planet as a whole, and that health cuts down to the soil. So the composting thing is really, composting is nothing more, in the simplest terms, it's about creating soil, healthy soil. And just like our bodies, the healthy soil has fundamental nutrient requirements, and those are designed within the intelligent design system to take care of themselves. So carbon is a fundamental requirement for that to take place. Hydration is a fundamental, and when I say hydration, I'm not just talking about water, and I know you, that's one of your four pillars of health is hydration. But what we're learning now, largely from the research of Dr. Gerald Pollack at the University of Washington, is that we were raised, when we took life sciences in seventh grade, to believe that water exists in three forms, solid, liquid, and gas, ice, liquid, and gas. And now we believe there may be even a fourth state of water, which is more gelatin in nature. And I think some people call it structured water, some people call it EC water, exclusion zone water. But it exists on and around, inside and on and around every cell in our body, as well as every cell in every plant and every cell in every animal, and even into the microbial levels of the life that exists in soil. So the bottom line is, and from a permaculture perspective, healthy soil will create healthy plants that will feed healthy people and healthy animals. And so we get to be the beneficiaries of that food chain if we're consuming plants and animals that have been feeding on and from that healthy soil. We win. We win. Then it's taking care of that 90 or so minerals and elements that our bodies require to be healthy. If I misstated the number, you can correct me.
No.
But composting is just one methodology. I think of it sort of like this. Composting, in the interest of achieving health, is sort of like having a gym membership in the interest of achieving health. Does it help? Yeah, but it is not the end in itself. What we have to do is learn and understand what creates and sustains and regenerates healthy soil, which it is a lot of things. Primarily, though, it has to have sunlight. and it has to have living creatures and plants on it and in it at all times. And that's where our, in our 100 years of industrial farming, I think, has kind of not done us a service, because whenever we turn that soil repeatedly year after year and multiple times per year, it basically it is desertifying it and killing the very life that it needs to regenerate itself. Let me stop there and let you ask me questions or challenge me if you'd like to.
No, that's great. One question, and I don't want to put you on the spot. I haven't looked this up myself, and I don't know if it even exists, but are you aware of any research from the kind of permaculture world that compares the nutrient densities or the nutrient levels of the foods that are produced in this kind of environment versus conventionally raised food? Have you seen that?
You know, Doc, I saw some about 2 weeks ago, but I cannot, from the top of my mind, I can't cite the author or even the date of that research. So I did see some about 2 weeks ago where they were, that was the researcher's intent was to do that comparative analysis.
Right.
But I can't remember the author.
Okay. Well, you know, this just makes common sense, and that's the same with in medicine. You know, everybody wants proof and evidence and wants to see a double-blind placebo-controlled trial and all that, which is fine. But it just rings true to common sense. So I kind of have that common sense standard first, and then if man can come and prove it through scientific, you know, method, that's great. The problem in medicine, the scientific method is corrupted and co-opted, and data can be manipulated. But this would be a pretty simple study. I don't think it'd be too corruptible. When you're talking permaculture, do you see that folks tend to lean more towards, you know, animal production versus vegetable fruit production, or is it really all got to be there together?
All together. I mean, the purists are it's an integrated system, and one of the real fundamental elements of those of permaculture purists is. Cuts back to that issue of hydration, and it doesn't matter if you get 5 inches of rain a year or whether you live in Washington State and you get, you know, whatever they get, probably, you know, 50 inches a year. Whatever moisture that falls on wherever you are, one of our fundamental practices is figuring out how to capture and hold that moisture on that property as long as possible, because that is, I mean, that is the lifeblood. And you and I both know most of the human body is water.
Right. 70%.
Same thing is true in plants. Same thing is true in cactus. Same thing is true in animals. The physicist Richard Bohm, a contemporary of Einstein and Heisenberg, spent his whole career trying to figure out what that medium was that seemed to serve as the connective tissue between all of the physical elements in the universe, and I would submit to you that it has something to do with water somehow in some form. But holding, spreading, sinking on your product it's the, if you will, the interconnected tissue that allows the bacteria, the fungal net, mycorrhizal net, viruses within the soil. You alluded to this earlier when you were talking about the human body. The enzymes, stuff is required for life in the soil just as it is in life in the human body. And so when we create the conditions that allow those interconnected and interdependent living things to do their job, whether it's an earthworm leaving its castings, or whether it is a virus that is attacking lesser than healthy bacteria and eliminating them in the soil, those are all by design. So the bottom line is we have to capture Well, in fact, according to Dr. Pollard, you know, basically you and I are walking solar powered batteries ourselves. But right. when we create the conditions that allow the living creatures to use the moisture in the soil and to collect the sunlight, and then they generate their own versions of carbon. We can accelerate that. Sometimes we do it compost, but even a simple practice that my wife and I use now all the time, we never throw away paper, pasteboard, feed sacks. Those all turn back into soil on our property. And it's amazing how quickly they do turn back into soil. But we do not send them to a landfill any longer. And it's all in the interest of creating rich soil. One comment about rich soil, and I know we're running short on time. There are somewhere between 6 and 7 billion people on this planet now. One teaspoon of healthy soil has the equivalent number of living creatures in it.
Wow, that's incredible.
6 to 7 billion. That's amazing. That is amazing.
It is amazing. It kind of reminds me of the human microbiome in our gut. You know, 10 times more microbes in our body than there are human cells. And we think there's around 50 to 70 trillion human cells, 10 times more bacterial, viral, parasitical, just these microbes. Amazing interconnection between our world, our earth, like you mentioned, the sun, the sun's radiant energy, solar energy to the plant and the chlorophyll taking that energy in, and eventually we eating that or an animal eating that, we consume the animal, but a transfer of all these not only nutrients but energy, and ultimately it's this life cycle, and we're also interconnected. It's incredible. If someone is interested, we only have a couple minutes here, Nelson, but if someone wants to learn more about this, maybe they don't know a thing, maybe they're a young ag producer and looking to do something different, what's the best way to start exploring? Do you recommend some books, websites, or what?
Probably the gold standard. I mean, there's tons of permaculture websites, and it ranges everywhere from the hobby practitioner to the severe prepper group. But Jeff Lawton, that's Geoff Lawton, Lawton, is a protege of Bill Mollison's, the father of permaculture, and he has a worldwide network now. But I believe permacultureinstitute.com, I believe, is the URL on there. And that's probably the gold standard for information, education, and connection.
Okay. Well, great. And also, for you listeners out there, you want to hear more from Nelson Coulter. You were interviewed, weren't you? It's probably on YouTube or somewhere by one of these permaculture groups.
I get interviewed a number of times. But if you go to my website, nelsonwcoulter.com, you can listen to my or read my blatherings on both topics. Related to permaculture as well as education, which is my trade.
Well, it's wonderful. And how about taking some students or just interested parties who would want to come down and visit your place and actually see firsthand? Do you ever do that, give tours?
We have. And if you want, my contact information is on my website. So if someone has those interests, I'll be glad to talk to them. They can get my phone number or email me, either one.
Great. Well, that's one of my passions, is to try to encourage some of these young folks, even high school or college students, maybe find a young local ag teacher. I don't know what the constraints are in the school districts for ag teachers, if they are stuck to a certain curriculum or just, you know, making pigs that will win the Houston Livestock Show with GMO feeds. But I want to find somebody who will be a game changer set the course for some of these young people to have some good local permaculture type thought process permeate West Texas and get locally grown foods readily available. Again, sort of selfishly, that makes my job a lot easier when we have readily available foods and all the local restaurants could utilize these kind of ingredients and everyone's kitchen can be full of these ingredients and have two or three or five or ten farmers markets around here. That's really the direction we need to go. And I always want to encourage young folks out there who are listening to consider this. And there are plenty of people who have gone before us to help make the way easier. And Nelson Culture is one of those. So I encourage all the listeners to get on Nelson's website to learn more. If you have some kids or grandkids who seem to be bent this way, you know, encourage them to look into this. I think it is the future of agriculture, just as functional medicine is the future of medicine. You know, money has driven so many thought processes in our past, and like Nelson said, big ag, big, and same as big pharma, these big groups and institutions, you know, profit and money is really at the bottom of the, is it the motivation behind so much of their policies? We've got to produce money, money, money. These guys are not looking at what's the most beneficial thing for the individual's health from a doctor's standpoint, pharmaceutical standpoint, or the agricultural food production standpoint. The nutrient density of the food is not the number one goal. It's how do we make money? And I'm not against making money, but that should be secondary to what's the most beneficial thing for the end user. What's the most beneficial thing for my patients? It just happens to be that it's not pharmaceuticals. So anyways, Nelson, thank you very much. Again, sorry for missing the date on you and having you on the road, but we sure appreciate you joining us today.
No problem. I'm glad we were able to make the connection.
Well, me too. Safe journeys, and look forward to talking to you again in the future.
All right. Likewise.
Okay. Thank you, Nelson Culture, everybody. Again, appreciate Nelson being with us on the show today. You've been listening to You're the Cure with Dr. Ben Edwards, MD, of course, brought to you also by Veritas Medical. Check out the website, veritasmedical.com. You can always call us right there at the clinic, too, 1-855-6-VERITAS. Dr. Edwards, we appreciate it once again. We look forward to seeing you back here next Monday on the show. And thanks, Melody Wilkes, sitting in with us as well. Mm-hmm. Any final thoughts from you, sir, before we wrap up this morning?
Well, just want to encourage everybody to continue to learn. We have resources on the website that point you to different articles, different books, different videos, different doctors that are doing what we do. It's all about learning that you are the cure. Your body has what it needs to get well if you give it the raw materials and avoid the toxins that impede the normal function of your body. So continue to explore and educate so that you can be well and not need a doctor. That's our whole goal.
All right.